thank them for their service. Well, I've been on holidays. I took my husband with me. We had 3 weeks of lovely holidays. We didn't go very far. We went all the way to Big Qualicum and all the way over to Sprout Lake. But it doesn't take us getting away very far to feel like you've gotten away. Really, just getting away from the farm is enough, right? And the chores that kind of stare you in the face. We spent quite a bit of time camping. I think we only spent probably 2 or 3 nights at home in our own bed. We were in our trailer most of the time, which was absolutely lovely. We got to spend some time with family members, people that I don't see nearly enough of throughout the rest of the year. And we even took a load of stuff over and got it set up in our daughter's new apartment so she's ready to get going at her second year at UBC. So it was a little bit of everything in our holidays, but it was quite nice. In between all of that, Simon and I actually managed to squeeze a little bit of time into doing one of our favorite things to do on holidays, reading. We're really exciting people. We both love to read. Our idea of a date night is to go to the bookstore and hang around for an hour, cruise the shelves. The treat about holidays is that I get to read for pleasure, because the whole rest of the year I have to dedicate my reading time mostly to reading textbooks for my studies or reading books that kind of help in what we're doing around here. So there's not a lot of room for pleasure reading. But one of the treats of summer for me is I get to just read what I want to read, just a good story. Well, because it's such a treat and it feels so precious, I can be a little bit picky in selecting what books I'm going to read. I spend quite a bit of time, sometimes probably too much time. I talk to people about what books they've read and ask them if they have any recommendations. I read reviews on Amazon, and I have some websites that I actually go to specifically dedicated to reviewing new books, and I read all those and trying to figure out what book's going to scratch the itch. What's the kind of story am I looking for? It's kind of funny. What I found in the course of doing that is that some of the reviews I read or the reviews I even get in person from people, some of them I agree with and some of them I don't. Sometimes it's not even like we've read the same book. It's the strangest thing. Well, the fact is, though, that it proves that different people get different things out of the very same book. If you've ever been part of a book study, you've experienced that. Different things strike different people. One of my friends, who is an avid reader, she loves stories with depth. And for her, they're even better. If there's a little bit of darkness or tragedy to them, that just makes it more real and weighty and believable for her, I think. I really respect her and admire this in her. And I wish I was like that, but I'm not. The truth is, I'm a pretty shallow pleasure reader. For me, pleasure reading is purely about escaping. And I'm a little bit of a romantic, well, quite a bit of a romantic, so I really like it when it works out in the end for my character that I've known to love. I don't like it in those tragic endings. They just make me mad, and I'm sorry I wasted time on the whole story. I'm kind of shallow when it comes to pleasure reading. Well, so consequently, my friend and I, we talk about books, and she can read exactly the same book as I do, and she's raving about it, and I hate it. Because in the end, I think it has something to do with what each of us is expecting to get out of the story, what we're expecting to get from it, and whether or not we feel like it's actually delivered that for us. And I kind of think this is actually true, not for us just with books or even entertainment, movies and television and stuff like that. I think it's pretty much a kind of a basic principle in our lives. How we respond to something is very often shaped by what our expectations have been of it. I dare to say this morning that I think that might even apply at times to our relationship with God. How we respond is very often shaped by our expectations. This month, while Phil is away, as I said at the start of the scripture reading, we're going to work our way together through the 6th chapter of John's Gospel. If you've ever looked at it as a chapter, it's like this theological watershed. And I confess, I tried to find lots of ways to get around preaching on that this summer, because it's a little intimidating. But God kind of wouldn't let me off it. So here we are. It begins with this pillar story of Jesus' ministry, his miraculous feeding of more than 5,000 people. The text tells us there was 5,000. That's just men, we know. So all the other people, there could have been three times that many. We don't know. But it starts with him feeding this huge crowd with nothing more than that little boy's packed lunch. It's an incredible story. In chapter 6, John starts by recounting the event itself, and then he launches into this quite extensive theological discussion with the crowds who were there that day. It's just one of a number of explanations that Jesus gives to people over the course of his ministry, explanations that are really designed to point them to who he was and to what he had come to do. In this instance, his explanation is built on his claim to be the bread of life. Now, as we come to this text today, it's interesting and it's important for us to realize that apart from Jesus' resurrection, this is the only miracle story from his life that was chosen by all four gospel writers to be included. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all decided this one needed to be in there, and for that reason alone, we should pay very close attention to it. In John's Gospel, this comes to us in a section that we refer to as the Book of Signs. It's a collection of the seven miracles that Jesus performed. In each case, John recounts the story of the miracle itself, and then he includes some comment about how those who were present reacted to it and what, if any, impact it had on them. Now, I think it's easy for us to think that if Jesus were to perform some incredible miracle here this morning, something on the scale of feeding 5,000 people, we might fall down in awe, all of us, on our knees, worship him, say, Jesus, you are Lord, and commit to following him forever. But the truth is, friends, I don't think we all would. People never have. Read the Gospels. John shows us that in many cases, people's response to these incredible, spectacular miracles, they were often quite diverse. There was lots of variety in the way people responded. Some people did worship him. Some people were convinced and then committed to follow him. But other people questioned and even doubted. And then, even more, others found some sense of threat in his miracles. That was often what we see from people who were quite established in the religious community. They felt threatened by what he was doing. John's intent is not just for us to look at the spectacular miracle. He also wants us to pay attention to the different reactions that people have to them. And that's a bit about what we're going to be doing together, exploring together this month. We are going to return to this amazing story, but we will spend quite a bit of time noticing and exploring how the various people who were present responded to what they had witnessed, and in turn, how Jesus responded to them. So let's start by setting the scene. It all begins just before Passover. Remember, that is the week every year when faithful Jewish people would gather together to remember all that God had done when he had rescued them from slavery in Egypt under Moses' leadership. Jesus is with his disciples on this particular day. He's on a hillside sitting there having a chat with them. They're in Galilee. His popularity has been growing. He's been doing all of these miracles, and it's gotten to the point that word has spread so that he can't really appear in public without a huge crowd gathering around him. People are anxious to get a chance to see the next miraculous act, or even better, be a part of it, benefit from it. It was that kind of a crowd that found him on the hillside that day. And Jesus looks at them, and he seems to decide, we don't really know why, that he wants to meet them at their point of need, at their most immediate point of need. This is not uncommon for Jesus. And for them, it's a very physical, very human, practical need. They're hungry. It's dinner time. we read that he offers that funny little test to Philip. A little bit of background. Philip was a local boy. So if you were asking for a restaurant recommendation, Philip's the guy you'd ask. Where can we go to get something to eat, Philip? That's basically what he said. Well, Philip may know where to get food, but he's very practical. You know, there's always a very practical one on the team, isn't there? And he says, yeah, Jesus, we got two problems. One, there's nobody around here that can provide that much food. They're all small operators. And two, even if we could find somebody, we do not have enough money to pay for that bill, Jesus. He points out what's pretty obvious. I can kind of imagine Jesus going, oh, like he didn't know. Well, meanwhile, Andrew, he's a bit different. He's kind of practical and kind of an active, go get him, get on with it kind of guy. So he's, while they're having this conversation, he's been polling the crowd, trying to see if anybody's got any food they might want to share. And he's found what is one of my favorite characters of the entire Bible. Somebody whose name we will never know. A little boy who we know was probably quite poor. And he has said to Andrew, this is what I've got. It's my lunch. But you can have it and give it to Jesus. It's five simple little probably flatbread barley loaves. Maybe his mom baked them. And a couple of fish. Maybe he caught them. But give it to Jesus. He realizes it's not very much. He was just a boy. He was only supposed to feed him. They realize it's not nearly enough to make a dent in the great need before them. But regardless, he gives it to Jesus. And honestly, we could pretty much stop there, couldn't we? Because it's such a great message for us. Well, we're not told how Jesus responded to that boy. But in my imagination, and I think God likes to use our imaginations, I think he might have looked at him with a smile and maybe a wink. Because that boy, he was about to see Jesus do something very, very cool. John incredibly briefly tells us that Jesus took the food, he gave God thanks for it, and then he passed it out. That's it. That's how John describes this incredible miracle. To all 5,000 plus people. And then when everyone is stuffed, you know that feeling of being stuffed, he asks the disciples to go and gather up the leftovers, and that fills 12 whole baskets. John doesn't use very many words to describe something that if you imagine it, it must have been incredible to behold. Well, this is the point where we get to the part about how they react to this miracle. Because John tells us that it starts to dawn on this crowd that Jesus really is something special. Maybe even that prophet Moses had told them was going to come. Maybe even the Messiah. The king they've been waiting for since the days of David. If that's the case, if that's who he is, then let's get on with it. What are we waiting for? And so they start to plan, and they prepare to approach him with the sole purpose of making that happen, making him king by force, if necessary. That's a really interesting response, and one that we're going to dig into in a minute. Now, Jesus is on to them, as Jesus often is, as he's often on to me and you, and he's just like that. He realizes what they're planning, and so he slips away quietly by himself. Eventually, the disciples look around and realize that he's gone, and so for them, nothing to do but go back home to Capernaum, so they get in their boats and head off. But as they're out making their way down the coast of the Sea of Galilee, they get caught in one of the storms the Sea of Galilee is famous for. And they're rowing and rowing against these windy waves. When they see Jesus coming to them, not in another boat, not walking along the shoreline, but walking on the water. understandably, they were freaked out. It's kind of easy to sit here and think, you know, it'd be cool to see Jesus walk on the water. But honestly, I think if you were to see Jesus walk on the water, you'd be freaked out too. When God moves in a way that is bigger than the irrefutable laws of nature, I don't know about you, but I get this sense of how big God is. And then how very small I am. The men in the boat, friends of Jesus or not, were terrified when they saw him. And so he says to them, "It's me. Don't be afraid." Now, maybe it was the sound of his voice, or maybe it was just the sense of assurance in his word. But they heard him. They suddenly recognized him. And immediately they wanted him in the boat with them. And then we're told, poof, they were at Capernaum. Another third miracle on that night, just tucked in there, and it's easy to miss. Well, meanwhile, the next morning, this incredible crowd of people who've been hanging out on the hillside, still talking about the events of last night, as you would, they start to realize Jesus isn't here anymore. And so they pursue him once again. Like the disciples, they're like, you know what? Logical place to look, his home base, Capernaum. Let's make our way there. And so they head off, likely driven by their plan to make him king, and make their way to Capernaum. Now remember, I offered the thought way back at the beginning that maybe our reactions to God are shaped by our expectations of him. I think that this story illustrates that point from two perspectives. There's kind of two groups going on here. There's the crowds and there's the disciples. And they have two very distinct and very different reactions to what Jesus did. Reactions that probably were shaped by what they were expecting from him. So let's start with the crowds. Remember, it said these are the days leading up to Passover. Well, you know how leading up to Easter, we find ourselves thinking about the events of those last few days, about the Last Supper. We're thinking about the events of the crucifixion and then his resurrection. That's what's in our minds in that time. Well, for Jewish people, in the days leading up to the Passover, they would have had the same kind of thing going on. They would have been thinking about Moses and about the plagues that God had sent and how Pharaoh had been hard-hearted. They would have been thinking about that incredible escape through the waters of the Red Sea and then all the stuff that happened in the wilderness over those 40 years. That would have been on their minds. As they pondered all the miracles that Jesus had done, especially this last one, feeding that crowd, they were starting to connect the dots. This is not just any rabbi. This Jesus, he might be the one Moses talked about. The one God told Moses to tell them he was going to send. But it's confusing because he doesn't appear to be putting together an army. And he doesn't even really appear to have much of a campaign strategy. From their perspective, he just kind of seemed to be diddling around out in the boondocks, way out there in Galilee, a long way from the center of power in Jerusalem. He may be the leader that God had promised was going to come, but he sure wasn't much of a strategic planner. But they helped. They were going to help. So they started to plan. This part makes me wiggly. Maybe it will make you wiggly. They did what we often do when God isn't doing things the way we think he should. They plotted, planned, to take matters into their own hands. They will make him king, by force if necessary. I think this happens to all of us from time to time. It's a great temptation for us. We face a problem, and we find ourselves praying for God's help, which in and of itself is a great thing to do. It's a good thing. You should do that. But the problem comes when instead of just bringing our problem to him, and asking for his help and trusting in his faithfulness and his wisdom to figure out how to best help us, we end up telling him exactly what we want him to do to help us. We know the result we want to see. And so we ask for that. And sometimes I even tell him how to go about doing it. The problem with all of that is that if you really think about it, when we do that, we're actually more interested in what God can do for us than we are in God himself, which is really the point. So it turns out that as long as he's doing what we want, we're happy. But if it stops doing that, then we lose interest pretty quickly. I'm sure you can see all the problems with this approach. The biggest is we're not really trusting in God's care for us. And at its heart, the relationship Fiona told us God has designed us for, at its heart, it's about trust. We're often being manipulative when we do that with the one who's already given everything for us. And we're so busy waiting for that specific answer we want to see that we sometimes miss the miracle he does right in front of us, the answer he actually gives us, because it looks different than we thought. That's what's happening in the crowds who were following Jesus around, and I dare say it happens in all of us sometimes. They're not bad people, they're just like us. Well, let's contrast that with what we see the disciples doing and how they reacted. When Jesus fed the crowds that boy's lunch, we aren't told very much about the disciples. We're not told how they visibly reacted or felt. We're just told simply that when Jesus told them to go gather up the leftovers, they did. And I think much is revealed in that. Because can you see the difference? There's this humble, quiet, willing obedience. And how different does that look from the crowd's assertive, manipulative, plotting? They're quite different. Where the crowds try to lead Jesus where they want him to go, the disciples simply just follow him as he leads. And then later, when he comes to them walking on the stormy waves, we get to see a much more pronounced reaction. We're told that they were terrified. Now I'm going to read that part of the story again, and I want you to pay very close attention. Listen for what it is that calms their fears, because it might not be what you first think. It says, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near to the boat, and they were terrified. But he said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. Then they wanted to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the land toward which they were going. Did anyone notice that it doesn't actually say he calmed the storm? Kind of jumped out at me. That wasn't what settled them. It was simply the sound of his voice. And those words, it is I. That's what changed their hearts from paralyzing fear to a strong, compelling desire to have him with them in that boat. It is I. Three simple words. Three simple words that really promise nothing more than his presence with them. It reminds me of when our kids had nightmares and they'd cry out in the night, and Simon, God bless him, would get up and he'd go into their dark room, and what would he say in the dark? He'd say, it's okay, I'm here. It's exactly the same thing. For them, the sound of their dad's voice made them feel safe and calmed their fears. For the disciples, the sound of Jesus' voice, his presence, calmed their fears. See, unlike the crowds, it wasn't something really that Jesus did, some spectacular thing that drew them to him. It was just his presence. The realization that he was there with them. That was all it took. This really makes me think about something that we do that I wish we didn't do as much. It makes me think about the final words Jesus says in the Great Commission. When we say the Great Commission, which was the last charge Jesus gave to his disciples after he was resurrected, before he was ascended, he basically said, go and do the work I have for you to do. You know the words. Go into all the nations, making disciples, teaching them everything I've taught you, and baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And we often stop there. Jesus didn't stop there. He said, the last thing he said, and remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. He promised us his presence with us always, forever. It's a powerful promise. It is the promise that actually changes everything. It's ours. It's each of yours. And it changes everything. So with that in mind, this week I would like to invite you to take some time. Find a quiet time. And reflect on your last week or so. And as you do that, ask yourself this. Was there some way in that week that God let me know that he was with me? It's possible you may not have realized it at the time. It might have been different than you expected, or maybe there was just lots of busyness and distractions. It's easy for us to miss seeing God in the moment, and that's why it's helpful sometimes to stop and to look back, because it's easier to see God sometimes in retrospect. So I encourage you, when you have a bit of time to yourself, find a quiet place. Think back over your week and look. Was there some way that God let you know that he was with you? And now let me pray for you. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this incredible promise of your presence with us. We ask for the grace to hold that purely in faith. And we confess that we find it hard to notice you sometimes, hard to recognize that presence, hard to recognize you. So I pray for all of us. I pray that you would first of all grace us with a little bit of time and a little bit of space and a desire to take this time to look back. And I pray for the grace when we do that, that you would pop up in the darndest places as you do, that we would get to see you, and that we would realize you are with us. Jesus, be with my friends as they do this. In your name.